Hi, this is Pep Phelan here from the Poach Centre, and I have with me today Jacob Prenn. Hi, Jacob.
Hey, Pep. How are you?
Good. How are you going?
Yeah, not too bad.
Nice to see your face again.
Likewise.
Okay, so tell me more about yourself, Jacob. Where you're from, your profession, and what you're up to.
Yeah, sure. So I live in Hobart, in Tasmania, and I've grown up here in Tassie, but my Aboriginal family are Worimi. So my nan comes from a little mission town called Karua, which is just north of Newcastle in New South Wales. But I'm very much a part of the Tasmanian Aboriginal community down here. So at the moment, I work as a lecturer at the University of Tasmania, and I teach in social work. So I belong to the School of Social Sciences. And I'm teaching a final year unit called Collaborative Leadership, Innovation and Entrepreneurship in Social Work Practice. Mm-hmm. I also am studying a PhD. So the first draft is finished of it, and I'm just going back through some of the early chapters and cleaning those up at the moment. And I am also an Aboriginal health worker. So I'm really interested in some of the stuff that's going on at the moment around COVID and the clinical responses to that.
So what's interesting you the most about COVID and the responses within Aboriginal health?
I suppose it's a worry. The reason I'm worried about it is because there's already a lot of comorbidities that Aboriginal people have. And if another health problem like COVID gets established in particular communities, whether they're urban or rural or remote, then that will be really bad for a lot of people, especially those that have existing health conditions. And so like my dad is an example. He's got rheumatoid arthritis, and he takes a drug every so often when he has a flare up, and it basically shuts down his immune system. And so if he was to get something like COVID, that would just totally wipe him out. And yeah, he would really struggle with that. Yeah, that aspect I'm worried about. And I've been doing a little bit of training with the ANU, so some of the epidemiologists there, around some information that they're developing for Aboriginal health workers and some training packs, mm-hmm, to skill up the Aboriginal health workers so that they're able to do a really good job of performing that front of line health role that they do, which is treating people that may have COVID, but also educating the community around how to avoid getting it and what can happen if you think you might have it and what you need to do. So that's been nice that I've been able to contribute to that, and I hope that that will help in some way.
It's also quite collaborative because obviously you're at UTAS, you're working with Aboriginal academics at ANU to get that underway so that it benefits the community across, I'm assuming, the country?
Yeah, it'll be across the country. I'm not sure exactly. The team that I'm working with applied for some funding from the federal government a couple of weeks ago, and I think, mm-hmm, they're just waiting to see whether or not that gets approved. But yeah, if it does get up, then it would be right across the country to all Aboriginal health workers that work in a clinical setting that would be able to benefit from it.
How did you get interested in your particular profession or industry, and what was your pathway to get there?
I suppose it all started when I was about 18 or 19, and the local Aboriginal health service had some jobs going as trainee Aboriginal health workers, mm-hmm, at a Cert 4 level, and health is something I've always been interested in. So I applied for it and was lucky enough to get the job. From there, that's where my interest in health really grew. I did the health worker training for 2 years, I think it was, and mostly worked in the clinic and with youths. And then while I was doing that, I was also studying at uni part-time, which isn't a good idea. I wouldn't recommend anyone working full-time. And I think I studied full-time for 1 year as well, and it wasn't good. It really just grew from there. Finished my bachelor degree, and then I decided I wanted a break from Aboriginal health and decided to do a social work master's. But it's funny how these things work out. So I did it to try and get away from Aboriginal Health to have a break. But as soon as I finished, I went straight back into Aboriginal Health.
Yeah, you do what you got to do. Like whatever you're supposed to do on this planet, you always end up doing it.
Yeah, so there's something that always just keeps drawing me back. So I think I took a break for about a year or so. Because it's really challenging work, as we all know, and can be really tiring. And sometimes there's a blur of the line between your private life and your life as a worker. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to get people that would message me on Facebook at, you know, 12 o'clock at night, telling me they're feeling unwell and like quite unwell. And so I couldn't just ignore that. I felt that I had to do something. But just when that goes on for an extended period of time, it can start to really impact your own health. But then when I came back as a social worker, I felt that I had better skills to be able to deal with that. So things like supervision was really one of the central things I got from social work. So supervision, going and having sort of like debrief conversations with another social worker or someone that's a trained counsellor every month or so, just to talk about what was going on for you within the workplace and any stresses or concerns that you had, to be able to talk about that. So then I worked as a social worker for a few years, mostly in Aboriginal Health.
What were the main things that you were doing?
Yeah, so the main thing was working with Aboriginal men. So I took over Tassie's only Aboriginal men's group, which was here in Hobart, just up the road from where I am at the moment, actually, at a small to medium community organisation, and got some funding to build the state's first Aboriginal men's shed, and also got some funding to do this stuff, which we packaged up at the time, called Bush Venture Therapy, which was basically getting guys out on country, having like day trips or half day trips or camps on country. So that really got woven into the group. So we would do group activities 1 or 2 days a week. And then I'd work with guys individually outside of those group activities to get them well enough to be able to participate in the group, or if they had some more serious issues going on, continue to work with them while they were participating in the group. So it might have been liaising with the Aboriginal health workers at the local health service. I think there was some drug and alcohol programs that I would link them in with, or some justice programs. So liaising with them in a few different ways. Mm-hmm. So I did that for 3 or 4 years and I really enjoyed it. It was actually a really nice job, and I still go along now as a participant, but obviously can't go at the moment because COVID. But
so how did you go from being a professional clinical social worker and transitioning across into the academic space?
I think after about 3 or 4 years of running the men's group, I was starting to get a little bit burnt out. Like what I mentioned earlier with the Aboriginal health worker role, that real blurring of the lines between your personal life and your life as a worker, it really got broken down. So there could easily be 3 or 4 of me working in that Aboriginal men's space, like just in the greater Hobart area, but there was just me. Yeah. And so there was always that much work. I could never get to the bottom of it. So I just noticed that, after a while, it started to take its toll on me. A job came up at UTAS with the Pro Vice Chancellor of Aboriginal Research and Leadership, which was Maggie Walter at the time. And that was 3 days a week. So I applied for that and then kept doing the men's group 2 days a week for about another 12 months or so. In that 12 months, I was sort of keeping in the back of my mind that it'd be really good if we could find another guy to take this over for a bit so I could have a break. We did find another guy, and so got him settled and sorted to run that group. Mm-hmm. And then I stopped working there the 2 days a week and started to do a PhD part-time. Aboriginal men's health is what my PhD is looking at. And I'm specifically looking at that Bush Adventure Therapy program, which was the on-country trips. During that time that we ran those, they were really good for most of the men in the group. And I was just really interested why they seemed to work so well. And I thought, that would be a cool thing to do my PhD on. So stopped working at the men's group, sort of transitioned to the uni full time. So working 3 or 4 days a week and then doing the PhD a couple of days a week. And then last year, a fellowship job came up with the social work department. I applied for that and was lucky enough to get it. And that's been really great because they will pay me to do my PhD 2 days a week. So I feel really fortunate that I'm lucky enough to have that job, to do something I really enjoy doing, and then also do the teaching side of it.
What is it that you love most about your current job or your current role and your industry?
I really like the research side of it. So it's the 50-50 split. So it's half teaching, half research. And I do like the teaching as well. It's a final year unit that I'm teaching at the moment. We've got about 80 social work students across Tassie. The unit that I got to develop basically just had a paragraph that I had to develop it from. So social work being an accredited professional degree within university, the AASW, which is the Australian Association of Social Work, sets parameters that for us to be accredited, we've got to meet. That was all I had, was a paragraph to develop this unit and the name. Collaboration, innovation and entrepreneurship in social work. That's been great to develop that, and I was able to use some of the leadership skills that I got from the POACH program and integrate that into the collaboration. They already get taught collaboration skills in the year prior to me, in the third year. So I thought, how could I then build upon those foundational collaboration skills that they've got? The first module in the unit, there's two modules that go for 5 weeks each, is collaborative leadership, really looking at how they can take their leadership to the next level as social workers. Social work leadership is collaborative leadership. So it's not that traditional managerial leadership where it's someone, you know, you've got a leader at the front and you've got the followers working behind. Social workers are really about empowering other people and building other people up to be the best versions of themselves that they can be. Looking at that at the micro individual level, at the meso level between organisations, and then at the macro level, at the bigger picture social justice stuff that we know a lot about as Aboriginal workers, how that can feed down and impact on what we do.
How is that style of leadership similar and or different to Indigenous leadership?
Yeah, I reckon there's a lot of similarities, a lot of overlap. In the first couple of weeks of that unit, we look at where leadership actually comes from. And so if you trace it right back, you have some really early forms of leadership, one being the Chinese doctrine called the Mandate of Heaven. And so the Mandate of Heaven was similar to the divine right of kings. So you have someone that has been given a gift by God or powers by God to be a leader over a group of people. That in the West and in Chinese culture is sort of like the earliest version of leadership that I was able to find when I was doing the literature review. So that's really someone being like a figurehead. I think a head is a good way to think about it, telling others what to do. Whereas in Aboriginal cultures, I think of the leader being more as the nose. A nose being within the center of your face and then having people like your eyes and your mouth and your ears around it. That leadership is collaborative leadership. So working with other people, not dictating to other people what it is that they need to do. Collaborative leadership and that notion of the nose rather than a head, I think aligns well with Aboriginal conceptualization of leadership, which is collaborative and working with others.
What have you learned about influence, impact, and leadership from the work that you do?
The ability to be able to influence people is quite important regarding leadership. If you aren't able to motivate others or influence them to come along on a journey with you that you're wanting whoever it is that you're working with to undertake, then it's going to be quite difficult for you to reach that goal. Having that ability to be able to influence others and finding what motivates other people. So that transformational conceptualization of leadership, trying to aspire people to come along with you on the journey to reach that goal that you're aiming to achieve. I think when you've got a good leader that's able to do those things, you really notice it. And when you don't have a good leader that doesn't do those things, you also really notice it as well. Like I can pinpoint off the top of my head when I've had managers that haven't been leaders. They've just been managers, and the way that they went about leadership, I don't think was very good.
Yeah.
And if there was more collaborative and they had that ability to influence people and motivate people to want to achieve the same goals, then it would be more impactful.
There's many, many, many non-Indigenous people that want to assist in Indigenous health to reduce the disadvantage and promote the health and wellness of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia. What does allyship mean to you?
Allyship, I think, is really important. So Aboriginal people are only 3% of the Australian population. And to make meaningful change, we need allies to support Aboriginal people and to work alongside Aboriginal people to be able to achieve the particular goals that we're aiming to achieve. So if that's improving the lowered life expectancy of Aboriginal people, having allies that will walk alongside us in that journey, I think is important. But the issue arises when that allyship isn't empowering Aboriginal people to be leaders themselves and really take control and guide that journey and that process. If allies, and it's an easy trap to fall into, if allies start to disempower Aboriginal people and try and take over in that process, then the goals that you're trying to achieve might work for a little bit, but it will fall over eventually when that person steps away or those allies step away because they've been propping the whole process up rather than empowering and walking alongside Aboriginal people to really undertake that process themselves. Allies can be important, and I'm a believer in that just because in a settler colonial state, which is what Australia is, and understanding the structure of settler colonialism, if Aboriginal people are to make meaningful change, and because we're only 3% of the population, I definitely think that we need allies. But allies need to be aware, and also Aboriginal people, that process needs to be an empowering process for Aboriginal people, and they need to take leadership within that space. It can't be done by non-Aboriginal people, because when they go away, the whole process will fall over.
Yeah. So as an Aboriginal man and an allied health worker, what advice or guidance would you give allies about being responsible, activated and effective in their allyship?
Yeah. So I think reflecting on yourself first is really important, and understanding who you are as a person and perhaps privilege that particular social context may bring you, and historically how that has operated in a settler colonial society, which is what Australia is. Reflecting on yourself, understanding the historical through to the contemporary is the first step. And then, yeah, just not falling into that trap of disempowering Aboriginal people in that process, that for meaningful change to occur, that you need to walk alongside and empower Aboriginal people.
What do you see as the major keys to empowering Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and Indigenous people around the world?
Yeah, that's a really big question. I think there's lots of components to it. If university and doing quantitative statistics has taught me anything, is that it's not just one factor that will account for 100% of what's happening. It's a multitude of different factors. So if we fall into that trap that it's just one thing that will change, then we're going to forget about all these other things over here that also play a role as well. And I think one of those factors is education. Me personally, I'm a strong believer in the role that education plays. And to use myself as an example, if I hadn't undertaken my training as an Aboriginal health worker and then at university, then I wouldn't be in the position that I'm in now to be able to help and assist others. And that's not to say that every Aboriginal person just needs to go and get a university education and that'll fix everything, because it won't. There's a whole variety of different components that all need to be working together and going in the same direction for meaningful change to occur. I think there's maybe some overarching similarities amongst all Indigenous people, but there's also very unique individual issues for different Indigenous peoples around the world. And I don't quite know what exactly can help Indigenous peoples across the world. I think something like UNDRIP, which is the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, is a good document for nation states to adhere to, or settler states. That is a good guide, but also at that localized level and regional level, understanding what the specific issues are for those specific Indigenous people and having their voices heard and them being empowered to make meaningful change. I'm reading this book at the moment, which I've got here in front of me, called Settler Colonialism and the Transformation of Anthropology. I'd really recommend that. I haven't got to the end of it yet, so I don't know if settler colonialism, which is the particular sort of colonization that's happened in Australia and the other Kansas countries, where you get a settler population that comes and never leaves. So if you think of somewhere like Vietnam, where you had, they were colonized by the French, they kicked the French out, and so the French left. They've been able to, there's still power structures that are left, so like institutions and governmental systems and things that are really hard to get rid of. But colonization that they've experienced is different in that the settler has left, whereas in Australia and the other Kansas countries, United States, Canada, New Zealand, the settlers still remain. And that's really complex. And I don't know. I'm going to read the rest of that book and hopefully that'll tell me something.
you can share it with me once you finish reading it.
You know, I think things like the POACH program around leadership, like that's important, and it plays a role in a much bigger picture. Mm-hmm. So investing time and resources into someone like me to try and make change out in the world, and so me contributing to what the ANU is doing around the epidemiology for the Aboriginal health workers is an example of that, that I'm then able to use those skills and hopefully can make meaningful change for other people. Maybe that's one aspect, but there's a whole heap of other aspects as well.
Who have been the biggest influence on your career, whether they're Indigenous or non-Indigenous people?
So I've been really fortunate. I've had lots of really good mentors and role models over the years. When I first started as an Aboriginal health worker, this guy that also started as an Aboriginal health worker called Aaron Everett, he was a really big influence for me. So around that time, there was a thing in Tasmania happening called the Brighton Bypass. And the state government was building a road through this archaeological site that had 42,000-year-old relics in it. And Aaron was a heritage officer at the time and blew the whistle, basically because the processes and legal systems that were in place basically didn't make a difference to stop the destruction of that heritage. So I really learned a lot from Aaron during the couple years that took place. And so he was a really good mentor for me. And then I suppose in my professional career, Maggie Walter. So she is now my colleague, but was my boss for the last 3 or 4 years. So I really learned a lot from her. And I didn't know Maggie very well before I started working with her, but really got the chance to know her over those years that I worked with her. And I'm about half Maggie's age, and somehow she works nearly twice as hard as me. And I tried to keep up with her for about 12 months and nearly burnt myself out. She's just an amazing person, and I don't know how she does it, but she, yeah, has been a really good influencer on my life. The other one's probably my dad. Yeah, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be the person I am today. Yeah, he's been a really good influence on me and has always challenged me to try and do better in my life. So having him around has been really nice.
Thank you so much for speaking to me, Jacob. It was so awesome to see you and speak with you again.
See you, mate. Take care.